The two survivors told a harrowing tale. Roger and Pamela Mortensen recounted what happened the night before Thanksgiving in 2009. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time. They walked in on a home invasion in progress in Payson Canyon, about an hour south of Salt Lake City. They had gone to visit Roger's father, Kay, and when they knocked on Kay's door, a strange man opened it. Kay was inside, the man assured them, and then he brandished a gun once the couple walked in. They were trapped. The intruder wasn't alone. He had an accomplice. Pamela and Roger were tied up with zip ties and taken hostage by the two men. After the men left, Pamela and Roger freed themselves with a pocket knife and called police. They then went upstairs, and there, in the bathroom, was Kay, slumped over the tub. Kay Mortensen, 70 years old, was dead. Kay's throat had been slit, and he had been stabbed in the back of the neck. The retired engineering professor at Brigham Young University was on his knees over the bathtub when police found his body. Zip ties were on his wrists and ankles, which were bound together. A large knife that matched a set in Kay's kitchen was left in the bathtub. Pamela and Roger were interviewed by police and were asked about everything they could remember. According to their account, the intruders were two white men who were in their 20s. They looked similar, with short, dark hair that looked unnatural, like it was dyed or sprayed on. They drove a small, dark blue car that looked like a hatchback. Some of the small details Roger and Pamela rehashed, like the description of the men's gloves, didn't match up perfectly, and they struggled to find the right words to explain what these two burglars, gentlemen they called them, looked like. Roger had suffered from a previous brain injury and sometimes struggled to recall things. One officer asked if the men smelled like cigarettes or what shoes they wore. Pamela said she didn't know. "I knew you would ask me these types of questions because I used to work for law enforcement," she told the officer, who, according to the police report, was paying close attention to her body language. Pamela seemed calm. She wasn't outwardly upset. She wasn't hysterical, the way a victim should be, officers seemed to think. Pamela's father-in-law had just been murdered, and Pamela herself had been a victim of a crime. But the officer noted in his report that she wouldn't make eye contact with him. She kept glancing over the officer's shoulder as he interviewed her in the kitchen. Her eyes looked bloodshot and watery. It was the start of law enforcement's suspicions. Were Kay's own son and daughter-in-law responsible for his death? This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 192. The visit on November 16, 2009 was supposed to be a quick one. Pamela and Roger headed to Kay's house to drop off a pecan pie, Kay's favorite. Here's what happened that evening, according to Pamela.
We drove up to the house and we had to go up a lane, a dirt road to get up to, because his house sat up on the top of a hill. And when we got up there, prior to going up, we had called to see if he was home, but he did not answer his house phone nor his cell phone, which was not uncommon for my father-in-law. Sometimes he fell asleep and didn't hear the phone. And so when we got up there, there was a car parked in the driveway, not a car that Roger nor I recognized. So we just assumed the reason why he didn't answer the phone was because he had company. So we proceeded to knock on the door. I knocked on the door because, like I said before, we were just coming to drop off a pie.
It was around dinner time, a beautiful time of day in snowy Utah, dusk. The lights on the house were on. Pamela knocked on the door. A man answered it. It was someone Pamela didn't know, but she wasn't alarmed. She just assumed this was the fix-it man coming to take a look at the internet since it had been down, or someone working on the carpet. Kay often had people coming in to help him with things. This unknown man didn't look sinister.
The people that answered the door did not look like, they didn't have ski masks on. They did not look like, you know, anybody scary or anything like that. They just looked like regular people. And so I was not scared when they came and answered the door, nor did I think anything of it.
They walked inside and up the interior steps.
Then that's when I saw the gun.
One man held a handgun while a second man put zip ties on Pamela's and Roger's wrists. The couple was escorted into the living room and sat on the couch.
At that time, Roger started getting a little nervous and getting freaked out. And so I asked if he could please tell me where Kay was, where Roger's father was. And I was told that they had him upstairs tied up.
Pamela stressed that the two men never physically harmed them. They didn't touch them, other than putting the zip ties on. In fact, the two men were almost courteous. Pamela and Roger were ordered to kneel on the floor in front of the TV in the living room. The intruders wanted Roger, who had a disability and a back injury, to be comfortable while they were zip-tying his legs.
I asked because they told us to kneel, and because of Roger's having back problems and disability, I asked if he could sit, and they said that would be okay. And then we got our legs zip-tied at that time.
The men reached into their pockets and took their cell phones and Roger's ID.
Was, in your opinion, was a scary situation?
It was a very scary situation. Because I did not know if I was going to make it out of that house that night, or if my husband and I were going to make it out of the house that night.
Pamela explained what happened next.
They left the room, and then we were sitting there for a long period of time, I would say maybe about half an hour, 45 minutes, and I looked out that window, and when I looked out that window...
When you say the window, could you just point to
it? It was the big window that was right here.
Okay, they're on the east side of the home.
Correct. And when I looked out the window, I saw a figure, a person, outside the window. That person was holding like a broom or some kind of thing that looked like a broom in their hands. The person looked at me and just, I saw them make a motion like, put your head down. And I told Roger to put your head down and don't look.
Pamela said one of the men returned to the living room with a stool and sat down. He then peppered them with questions. Was Kay expecting any visitors? Kay's wife, Darla, should be coming home soon, Pamela and Roger told him. Darla had been visiting her son, who had just had a baby. The man didn't seem surprised by that. He asked more questions. Did Pamela and Roger have any children? Was anybody waiting for Pamela and Roger back at home? The mood changed.
We answered those questions, and then we were told that they were doing this because of their family, for their families. And then, prior to him coming into the room, Roger was praying because we had been alone for a little while. Roger was praying, and when they walked into the room, Roger was told that he could finish that prayer. And after that prayer, it seemed like the demeanor of them had changed a little bit.
The men ordered Pamela and Roger to lie about what happened. Tell the police three black men broke into Kay's house. Otherwise, we will hurt your family, they said. Then the two men left, taking Roger's driver's license with them.
We waited a while because we were afraid that they might come back. And about after 45 minutes, then I tried and I wiggled my arms to get myself out of the zip tie, which I was able to do. Then I reached into Roger's pocket. And in his pocket, on his keychain, he had a pocket knife. And we were able to cut the zip tie off of his wrist and then cut the zip ties off of our ankles. And then I went and picked up the phone that was in the living room and called 911.
She said as she was on the phone with 911, Roger went to the front door and locked it and then put a stick in the sliding glass door. They were scared the men would come back. Roger then told her he was going to go look for his dad. He went upstairs and found him in the bathroom.
Did you go upstairs?
At first, I did not go upstairs. But then when 911 asked if we were for sure that he was dead, if somebody checked his pulse, I went upstairs just in case if he was alive, that I could walk Roger through what he needed to do.
When the police arrived, Pamela and Roger were split up. They were taken to the police station in separate cars and were questioned apart. One deputy noticed while Pamela sat in a sergeant's car, Roger grinned at her and gave her a thumbs-up sign. When Roger realized the deputy was watching him, he quit smiling and hurriedly put his hands in his lap. Throughout the drive, Roger seemed fascinated by the police equipment and kept asking questions about how it all functioned. While waiting for his interview, he talked about the police-issued equipment, his ATV accident, his state job, and other random topics, according to the Utah County Sheriff's report. Roger put his hands on his face and briefly commented about his dad's death, but he didn't cry. The sheriff's report noted, "These moments of grief were seconds long." He then would speak of other random topics. Roger would repeatedly stand and walk around or stretch his back. He said this was from his back injury. Pamela was also chatty while she waited her turn to speak to law enforcement. She brought up what TV shows she was missing, her career at a sheriff's office in northern Utah, and other topics. When she made reference to Kay Mortensen, "I never saw any visible emotion," the deputy wrote in his report. Pamela looked at a photo lineup, but wasn't able to identify the two men. This world is a less interesting place with Kay's passing. Kay Mortensen's obituary chronicled his humble beginnings growing up on a farm. In his youth, Kay hunted and helped his family raise sheep and livestock and grow crops. He was clearly ambitious and intelligent, going on to pursue higher education and earning his PhD in a science-related field. Quote, "After working a few years in the industry, Kay became a faculty member at Brigham Young University, where he taught courses in manufacturing design, engineering technology, and mechanical engineering. He was a well-known and respected scholar and teacher for over three decades at BYU, mentoring undergraduate and graduate students alike. His lectures were known not only for their scholarly content, but his farming and other stories that piqued the interest of students and illustrated practical application for the principles he taught. Kay believed in self-preparedness, both spiritually and physically. He loved to talk and debate issues with colleagues, friends, and family, and loved to make his ideas and opinions known, especially on topics like global warming and politics." Kay had a black belt in karate. He loved guns. Everyone who knew him seemed to describe him as stubborn and quick to anger. He seemed suspicious of the government. He had built a secretive underground bunker on his property and stashed it with enough supplies to hide out for a year if necessary. Kay wasn't afraid of a fight. He was confrontational. But he was also generous with his riches, loaning out money when his friends needed it. Roger said he was best friends with his dad. Quote, "As best friends as you can be with a cranky old man." Roger had memories of Boy Scouts with his dad as a leader. As grown men, they rode motorcycles together. Kay was there to help his son out through tough times. In his personal life, Kay had been divorced twice and remarried to Darla after dating for 8 months. One neighbor said Darla had a calming effect on Kay. The couple had been married for about 3 years at the time of Kay's death. In addition to Roger, Kay was the father of three children from a previous marriage and had two stepchildren. Kay was a Mormon and a member of the Latter-day Saints Church. He and Darla had recently finished an 18-month-long mission trip. Roger, who had the keys to his father's house, took care of Kay's property while they were away. The obituary said Kay left behind a legacy of scholarship, teaching, farming, patriotism, and a fervent testimony and love of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It was a brutal crime, a man's throat slashed repeatedly. The news of Kay's death was shocking in the community. He was someone with a strong faith who lived in Utah County, where the Mormon-owned Brigham Young University was located, and the vast majority of county residents were members of the LDS Church. Utah County Sheriff's Lieutenant Mike Brower was a 15-year veteran of the department. He said law enforcement wanted to solve this murder, and they poured resources into their investigation.
Based upon your knowledge of this case, do you know approximately how many individuals were interviewed in connection with this investigation?
This was a fairly complex investigation due to the lack of initial information and evidence. I would estimate that at least 80 to 100 individuals were interviewed during the course of several months in this investigation.
The sheriff's office followed leads that went nowhere, like a troubled, gun-obsessed man who had walked into a hospital and asked about someone with a slit throat. Detectives also knew about some disputes in Kay's life. His family dynamics were certainly complicated, according to the Utah County Sheriff's report. Kay had two ex-wives. He was at odds with a sister in a dispute over guardianship over their mother and their brother, who had disabilities. Kay disowned one of his sons, who harbored a long grudge against his father over money. The son was upset over either college money or unpaid child support from his childhood. The sheriff's report mentioned both, and he had gone as far as to sue Kay over it, according to interviews conducted by law enforcement. Kay had also gotten into a legal skirmish with a neighbor who had a Great Dane that attacked Kay. One day, Kay shot and killed the dog, and the neighbor filed criminal charges against him, which Kay then beat in court. There was also Mike, a student Kay taught in graduate school, turned business partner. Kay and Mike worked together until Mike fired Kay after he apparently upset some customers or employees, according to Darla. Getting fired had strained Kay's friendship with Mike, but the two men had also started becoming close again. Darla told police that Kay helped Mike out when he was going through a divorce. When the market collapsed and Mike needed cash, Kay bought Mike's gun collection of more than 24 specialized firearms for $25,000. The two men were getting lunch on that very Monday to discuss Mike buying back his old collection. Did anyone have a financial motive to kill Kay? Kay was certainly worth a lot of money, as Darla acknowledged. She said they had a prenuptial agreement, so Kay's previously earned assets were protected if they ever split. Several people were in debt to Kay. One man bought equipment from him and still owed $50,000, according to Darla. Kay wasn't worried about the debt, however, and seemed confident he would eventually get paid. Another person hadn't paid Kay back for something from at least 10 years ago, although again, Darla said it didn't seem to bother Kay. Collecting his loans wasn't on Kay's mind, but something else was. Darla told police he was paranoid that somebody was out to get him. Kay always kept his doors locked. When the couple came home, they went through the garage, and he always had guns on him. He would tell her he wasn't going down without a fight. Darla didn't like Kay's fascination with guns, but she said she didn't have much of a choice. Guns made Kay happy. He was always using them and buying ammunition. Kay's concerns for safety went a step further, though, than most gun enthusiasts. He had built a bunker into the ground behind his house. It was a secret. Only close friends and family knew about it. Darla wasn't sure all that her husband kept in the bunker, but she did know that the majority of his guns were stored in two large safes in their master bedroom. Authorities reached out to a locksmith and were able to break open the two safes, but the rifles, handguns, and silver and gold coins Kay had were all there. The safe's contents weren't stolen by the home invaders. However, some of the guns from the bunker appeared to be gone. Detectives noticed the empty shelves inside. Who would want to hurt Kay? They asked Darla. The killer had to be someone he knew, she insisted. The man who always had a gun around and wasn't afraid to fire it wouldn't have answered his door for a stranger. Kay must have had his guard down with someone he knew, Darla believed. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gone down without a fight. The killer also apparently knew about the secretive bunker and knew that Kay was back home from his long church mission trip. Darla said she wanted whoever did this to be caught. Authorities were paying close attention to Darla's body language, too. Darla acted appropriately, the sheriff's report noted. Pamela and Roger Mortensen were cooperating with investigators and allowed them to search their home. Investigators noticed several letters that showed Pamela and Roger owed people money, including attorneys demanding payment for thousands of dollars. The letters appeared in various rooms, according to the sheriff's report. Investigators also found two round plastic containers with marijuana located inside the garage. Roger's green Jeep Cherokee was taken to be processed for evidence. Detectives also took Roger back to Kay's house so he could reenact what had happened. Roger remembered the man answering the door, and then the second man, the one holding the gun, telling the couple they were at the wrong place at the wrong time. He wasn't sure if the second man held the gun with one or two hands while also holding the zip ties. Roger said one of the men had a broom and was sweeping at one point, possibly destroying their shoe prints. Investigators said they didn't see any prints or sweep marks in the snow. They went inside the bunker, which had several empty shelves. Roger said some of Kay's guns stored in the bunker were gone, but he wasn't sure which ones. He thought some of Mike's missing weapons might also be among the ones taken. According to the report, Roger was very interested in going upstairs in the house to make sure everything was still there, even though the bloody bathroom hadn't been cleaned up yet. Could Roger remember any more details about what the two men looked like? He said he couldn't. The way he referred to them seemed interesting enough that detectives mentioned it in the report. Roger called the two men who murdered his father gentlemen. Separate from her husband, Pamela also returned to Kay's home with the detectives to recreate that night. She also called the suspects gentlemen and remembered one of them asking if the zip tie was too tight on her wrist. Pamela had different recollections than Roger. Both of them talked about Roger praying that night and the suspect interrupting him. Pamela said the man brought in a bar stool and sat down while Roger finished his prayer. According to the report, quote, there is a difference in the stories and that Roger is very clear that the suspect does not bring in a bar stool, nor does he sit on a bar stool at any time while he is talking to them. Pamela took a polygraph test where she discussed everything from her father-in-law's personality. He sometimes offended people and was a his way or the highway kind of guy, to the night of the murder. She couldn't remember if the men had on long or short sleeves, but said they wore gloves and seemed normal looking. They seemed to know that Darla was going to be coming home soon. Pamela acknowledged that she and Roger had financial difficulties, but she didn't bring up any inheritance money they might receive from Kay's will. She also wasn't a fan of some of her husband's friends. Quote, Pamela said being asked questions about the incident was like being interrogated. She said her heart rate would go up when asked questions about Roger's friends or suspect descriptions. She seemed uncomfortable when talking about the incident. According to media reports, both Pamela and Roger failed the polygraph tests. Detectives also listened back and analyzed the 911 call Pamela made on the night of the home invasion. When the dispatcher asked how many suspects there were, Pamela said, there could have been three. The sheriff's report noted that the dispatcher pushed for a description of the suspects, to which Pamela said, ma'am, I don't know, in an irritated voice. When Pamela handed over the phone to Roger, Roger said Kay was cold to the touch. He's leaned over, face forward in the tub, with his throat sliced with a butcher knife all the way up, he told the dispatcher. When the dispatcher asked why someone would want to kill his dad, Roger replied, "He's rich." The detective listening to the replay of the call thought Pamela's and Roger's voices sounded monotone. Quote, "At no time during the call do Pam or Roger request help or medical attention for Kay. Roger makes statements that he traveled up and down the stairs twice during the call. Again, I cannot hear in Roger's voice any stress or breathing changes." In a later interview with the media, Pamela said that's just her personality. She was always calm. Detectives interviewed one of Roger's friends, Bobby. Bobby contacted law enforcement and said he wanted to speak with them. Bobby thought of Roger as a father figure in his life, and they had been close friends for about a half dozen years. Bobby sometimes sold marijuana to him, and they would smoke together. Bobby lived in a camper in the Payson Canyon area. He told police he believed Kay's death was drug-related due to several known drug users and dealers associated with Roger. Those shady characters could be capable of homicide, Bobby said. One in particular was in prison, but could make arrangements behind bars for a murder to be carried out. Bobby said he knew all about the secret bunker. Roger had told him all about it, although Bobby had never been inside. He described the bunker in vivid detail and made it clear that Roger was very loose-lipped about it. Bobby also told detectives that it seemed strange that Roger and Pamela, who visited Kay often on a Saturday or Sunday to play cards or eat together, would go there on a Monday. Detectives also spoke to Laureen Mortensen, who was Kay's ex-wife. Laureen gave a disturbing portrait of her stepson, Roger. She told stories of unpredictability and irrational acts of violence and anger. She said he had gone through lots of trauma that changed his life and impacted him. Roger had been married multiple times. Pamela was his fourth wife. According to the sheriff's report, with one of his ex-wives, Roger got so angry he broke down a door during an argument. The report also stated that Laureen told them that in the 1990s, Roger had gotten drunk and drove his SUV off a cliff. He suffered head trauma and has trouble reasoning after the accident. She said Roger hasn't been able to hold down a job since and received Social Security disability. Laureen complained that Roger had problems with cocaine and with stealing. But Kay was always there to bail out his oldest son whenever Roger needed help. Kay helped Roger get off drugs. With their shared affinity for guns, Roger and Kay bonded over the weapons and traded guns together. Quote, Laureen said that she was concerned that Roger might have been involved in Kay's death. Laureen said she didn't understand how this could have happened because Kay was trained in karate. In another interview with law enforcement, Roger was again going over the details of what he said had happened that night. From the sheriff's report, quote, I explained to Roger that everyone is considered a suspect. However, before I finish saying suspect, Roger interrupts, saying, referring to him being a suspect. He shakes his head in the affirmative when I make this comment. He then tells me he watches CSI and asks us if we like watching CSI. I then mention it's our job to ask certain questions. Roger mumbles, did I kill my father? While shaking his head in the affirmative. I then ask Roger if he killed his father. He states no. I asked him if he had anything to do with it. He states, no, I do not. Roger was open about his disability and his brain injury, saying, I have serious brain trauma, I have impulsiveness, and I have a frontal lobe injury. Pamela was also confronted by a detective who told her there were inconsistencies with their stories. The detective was looking at the details. Who held the gun? What was the description of the suspect's gloves? Were they purple latex or fuzzy blue? And did the intruder sit on the bar stool in the living room? Pamela remembered Roger covering his head with his hands at one point, but that's impossible if Roger's hands were zip-tied. Was Pamela holding the pie, or did the suspects have it when she walked up the stairs inside the home? Roger thought the suspects called each other Ben and Jerry, but Pamela didn't hear that. There was blood everywhere in the bathroom, Roger had said, although the blood was hidden by Kay's body, so Roger couldn't have seen it unless he moved his father, which he swore he didn't. How did they exactly get out of the zip ties? And the investigators weren't satisfied with Pamela's and Roger's vague descriptions of the men. I don't have anything to do with this, Pamela said. This is like you just shot me in the chest. What about her husband? They asked. Was he capable of killing his own father? I wouldn't think he was capable of killing anybody, Pamela said. I know that Roger has felonies. Honestly, deep down in my heart, I would say no, and I would hope that I was right when I said that. I really hope that my husband would not ever want to hurt, kill anybody, let alone his father. Pamela and Roger obtained an attorney. The attorney provided their fingerprints to the sheriff's office. But by this point, after being accused of Kay's murder, they refused to willingly work with investigators anymore. They declined in assisting a sketch artist in drawing the images of the two men they said they had seen. All along, what made the murder investigation challenging, officials said, was the fact that the crime scene was so clean. No DNA, no fingerprints left. There was hardly any evidence, no forced entry, no drawers rummaged through. The only items taken had been Kay's guns in the underground bunker. It made authorities more suspicious of Roger and Pamela. Were they telling the truth? At trial, Utah County Sheriff Lieutenant Mike Brower testified how the couple became the two main suspects.
Now, you indicated that as the investigation was going on, Roger and Pamela Mortensen became the key suspects in this case, and that was after, based on interviewing numerous people such as Tammy Bills and also interviewing Roger and Pamela Mortensen themselves, correct?
Yeah, the first 2 days of interviews.
And one of the key factors that made them a suspect in law enforcement eyes was their inconsistent statements, correct?
That was one of the factors.
A prosecutor would later say that the Utah County Attorney's Office was stuck, not knowing where to go. So they took the case to a grand jury to see what would happen. The grand jury indicted Pamela and Roger Mortensen for murder. They were arrested shortly thereafter. As news reports announced the arrests in Kay Mortensen's murder, a 23-year-old man named Martin Bond was watching. Martin was thinking that he and his friend were getting away with murder. Roger and Pamela Mortensen spent nearly 5 months behind bars, but the stolen guns from Kay's bunker, along with an ex-wife with a big tip, were about to free them. 23-year-old Martin Bond was divorced and had been a Utah State University student after he had been discharged from the military. His mother told the Salt Lake City Tribune that he was a really good kid, an A student, and a loving father. She said he has severe OCD, that the military ran tests on him, and he did very well, but that it got to the point where he had a problem. Martin and his ex-wife were on good terms, and just weeks after their divorce, in late March 2010, Martin confessed to her. He, along with his friend Ben Reddick, had been involved in the death of Kay Mortensen. His ex-wife called the police months later, and soon the charges against Pamela and Roger were dismissed. Martin and Ben were arrested. The motive for the crime? Robbery. According to Ben, who took a plea deal, they wanted to steal Kay's guns, worth $20,000 to $30,000. To avoid the death penalty, Ben took the deal and was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison in 2011. Martin, on the other hand, would be taking his case to court. Martin Bond was charged with aggravated murder, aggravated robbery, and 3 counts of aggravated kidnapping. He went to trial in January 2013. In their opening statements, the prosecutor said it was a case that sounds like a crime novel, but wasn't fiction. He walked the jurors through what he believed happened that night in Kay's home. Kay had let Martin inside willingly because Kay knew his attacker. Kay was good friends with Martin's father. "This has been a long time coming," the prosecutor told the jury. His tone was something you don't often hear in a courtroom. He was apologetic as he insisted Martin Bond was the true murderer, not Pamela and Roger Mortensen, who had been wrongly arrested.
"We arrested the wrong people. We accused the wrong people. We made a mistake. I admit that to you. And we take absolute full responsibility for that. But what I want you to focus on, we got it right this time. No doubt about it, we got it right."
The prosecutor outlined his theory of how the evening of the murder played out.
"This is about a man, about Kay Mortensen, a good, decent man in our community. Kay was home on November 16th, 2009, minding his own business, cooking a little dinner, waiting for his wife to return from Salt Lake, and someone knocks at the door. Kay goes and answers the door. He allows the person to come into the house. Shortly thereafter, another individual comes into the house. Once they get in the house, they pull a gun on Kay. They put zip ties on his hands. And they say, 'Tell us where your weapons are.' Kay doesn't struggle, doesn't fight."
He said Kay grabbed the key to the bunker and at gunpoint opened it and showed them where his guns were. The men then took him back into the house.
"Since Martin Bond had been in that house before, he knew the layout of that house. He took him immediately upstairs. Took him in the upstairs bathroom. In the bathroom, it's kind of a small bathroom. You'll see pictures of it. There's a sliding glass door on the tub. Opened up that sliding glass door. Bent him over the tub. Secured his feet with zip ties so he wouldn't kick. At that point, Mr. Bond goes downstairs, grabs a kitchen knife, a big butcher knife, comes back upstairs, straddles over the top of Kay Mortensen while he's kneeling there over that bathtub, and repeatedly and brutally slashes his throat multiple times."
He said he then stabbed him in the back of the neck for good measure. Then he said the doorbell rang and they answered it. There at the door were Roger and Pamela Mortensen with their pie.
"And so Bond and Reddy let him in the house. And once they let him in the house, tell him you're at the wrong place at the wrong time."
He told the jury how several months later, the grand jury indicted Roger and Pamela Mortensen. Months later, he said Martin Bond's ex-wife had the guts to come forward.
"He had taken her with him when he dug those weapons. They buried those weapons after they left Kay's house. They buried them. And Martin wanted to retrieve those weapons and bury them in another location. So he got his wife to help him out with that. She knew what he had done."
He said Martin and Ben weren't even on investigators' radar at that point when Martin's ex-wife went to police. There was no DNA, no fingerprints tying them to the crime.
"So based upon the information, the Bond's ex-wife provided, a search warrant was written the following day. The police went to that house. Bond's ex-wife said that she had seen some of the guns still in the house that were stolen from Kay's home. These guns have serial numbers scraped off of them, but she knew that they were from the crime scene. So they served that search warrant. They found those guns. Even though those serial numbers were gone on the handguns, there was one weapon inside that front room, an M1A rifle that didn't have the serial number taken off of it. That serial number came back to Kay Mortensen's gun. They knew that Bond's ex-wife had told the truth.
Martin's ex-wife, Rachel, was 18 years old when she married him. They divorced in February 2010, but they remained on good terms and were friendly. Weeks after their divorce, in late March 2010, Rachel rented a U-Haul to help her ex-husband, who asked her to help him unbury some guns.
It was dark, and I just waited while he went a little further up the road and unburied them, and then we went back to the hotel that night.
How did you know what you were going up there to do?
Because he told me before we drove to Vernal.
Okay. What did he tell you that he was specifically going to do? Could you, the best of your recollection?
He said that he needed to move the guns because he was worried that Ben or somebody might go to the police, and he just didn't want them to know where the evidence was at anymore.
Martin knew Kay from childhood, Rachel said, her voice breaking on the stand. He had confessed to her.
He knew from childhood, and that he entered Kay's home and took his life and took Kay's guns.
Rachel testified that Martin told her Ben was actually the one who stabbed Kay.
And so, at that time, Martin indicated that it was Ben who actually killed Kay Mortensen. Is that?
Yes, he did.
Did Martin tell you what gun they pulled when they came into the house?
Not specifically, just that it was a handgun.
Okay, all right. And so, did Martin tell you that whether or not he was up in the bathroom at the time when Ben killed him?
Yeah, they were in the bathroom.
Together?
I don't remember.
Okay, well, that's fine.
Rachel told the jury that Martin told her about Roger and Pamela coming over and how they tied them up before ultimately deciding to let them go.
They went to the other room to talk about what to do with them and decided to let them go and told them to tell a different story to the police when they showed up and give them a description that was wrong.
Okay.
And then they loaded up the guns and left.
What did he tell you that they did with the guns after they left?
We drove back to Vernal and buried them.
Months passed since the day Rachel rented the U-Haul to help Martin dig up the guns and the time she went to the sheriff's office. But she said eventually she knew she had to tell what she knew, no matter how scared she was. Two people were being wrongfully accused. Utah County Sheriff's detectives searched Martin's home and found six guns in a hidden compartment under a furnace in the garage and one in a safe. When interviewed by a detective, Martin at first denied he had been involved with the murder. Then he changed his story and admitted to being at Kay's house that evening. A recording of the interview was played at trial. Here's an excerpt of what Martin told the detective. It's a little fuzzy because it's a recording of a recording, but you can make out Martin saying that Kay was surprisingly calm and serene right before he was murdered.
He was actually very, very, very cooperative. Was he scared? I would say no. Did he ever beg for his life? No.
During the trial, Detective Zach Adams read notes Martin wrote to another inmate in jail.
Well, Ben made the situation, and when Kay and I tried to talk to him. He freaked out more. He ended up threatening me and a bunch of other shit. A bunch of other shit happened. I apologize. It came to a point where he was going to kill him, but made me instead. He wanted me to have just as much to do with to lose if I decided to say anything. It was that or he said he'd shoot me. So no one could say anything. That's why his throat was cut. He wouldn't give me the gun. I thought he was suffering, so I stabbed him to try and finish him. Two more people showed up, and he wanted to kill them too. I refused, and he didn't have the balls to do it himself.
Dr. Edward Lays from the medical examiner's office in Salt Lake City conducted the autopsy on Kay's body.
With regards to the cutting of the jugular vein, is that fatal immediately, or how long would it take a person to bleed out with regards to that?
It's not going to be immediately fatal. It's not going to render him unconscious immediately either. It's because it's a vein that's returning blood from the head back to the heart. It's not under as much pressure as an artery would be. So it's going to be a fairly uniform flow. It is a major vessel. It's going to lose a pretty good volume. But whether this would take, you know, 1 minute, 3 minutes, 5 minutes for him to lose sufficient blood volume that he now passes out from shock until he eventually dies. You know, we really don't have any studies where this has been done experimentally to see how long it takes somebody to die. People with major blood vessel injuries have been known to do physical activity for up to 3 to 5 minutes, and that's even with injuries to the heart or to large arteries. So this is going to take a few minutes at least.
Pamela Mortensen, you heard her testimony earlier in this episode, also took the stand at Martin's trial and retold what happened as best she could remember. In closing arguments, Martin's defense argued that Ben had coerced Martin into killing Kay. The jury took 5 hours to deliberate.
We, the jury, having reviewed the evidence and testimony in this case, find the defendant, as to count one, aggravated murder, guilty.
Guilty on all counts. After the verdict, Martin agreed to a sentence of life without the possibility of parole in order to escape the death penalty. Even though he knew what he was going to be sentenced to in advance, that didn't stop Martin from asking the judge for a lesser sentence at a court hearing. "I don't use drugs, I don't drink," Martin told the judge, according to the Salt Lake Tribune. "I don't use tobacco products. I always thought corrections was for rehabilitation." The newspaper said Martin asked the judge to allow the parole board to determine whether he was worthy of a second chance. The judge declined, saying his hands were tied, and Martin was going to spend the rest of his life in prison. "Fair enough, Your Honor. Thank you," Martin said. He then apologized to the Mortensen family, calling Kay's murder a horrible tragedy that shouldn't have occurred. "I really did like Kay," he said. "He was a friend. I grew up liking Kay. But if I was really the monster that everyone thinks I am, Roger and Pamela wouldn't be sitting here today." And as for Roger and Pamela, Pamela told the media afterwards that they were just relieved that the truth had come out. The couple sued Utah County for the false accusations and false imprisonment that took away months of their freedom, made the community and their loved ones scorn them, and also cost them financially. A judge dismissed their federal civil rights lawsuit in 2012. In a statement, the two said, "It is hard to understand that falsifying information to a grand jury, especially by law enforcement, could be tolerated. In our situation, our rights to have compensation for the injustices inflicted on us by the detectives, sheriff's department, and public defender has been halted." And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. You can let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at PortJunkie, by tweeting me at PortJunkiePod, or by emailing me at podcast@portjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Gabrielle Roussan. To hear these episodes without the ads and to check out additional Court Junkie bonus content, head on over to courtjunkie.com/support. That will redirect you to my Patreon page. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.